She shrugged to cover her eagerness.
We just don't know. Right now, all we want is to talk to him.
What kind of dog? He stopped in front of her. What? She was thinking about which shelter she could check to find Big D.
What breed is your dog?
Since he's a rescue, I'm not sure. She smiled as the image of her dog changed her focus. He's all black with longish fur. He's got the body of a border collie, although the borders are seldom all black. I call him Wonder, 'cause you wonder. Her eyes were almost level with Wills's. He'd paused from taking notes. He was medium height, about 5'10", but with a heavy, hard-boned look. Maybe 40-something, but he could be younger. Homicide detectives were notorious for not aging well. He wore the requisite fedora of the homicide squad, but otherwise didn't appear to care about his clothes. Each time she'd seen him, he'd been wearing khaki pants and a short-sleeve shirt of indeterminate blend. He glanced back at the bodies, then back to Salt. She thought she saw something familiar there in his look. She broke eye contact and asked, "You think maybe you can let me know if you get anywhere with Chanel's, the McLeod murder?" Dropping his head, he shrugged.
"We won't get anywhere with that homicide. No witnesses coming forward? Forensic evidence in a crack apartment? Forget it."
"What about the autopsy?"
"Two gunshot wounds, .38 caliber, one in her shoulder, one to the heart. From the angle of entry, it appeared she was crouched in the closet when she was shot."
"So she wasn't put there to hide her body, and she didn't run there after she was shot?" The contract hearses arrived to cart the bodies away.
"Looks like she was trying to protect herself, covering her heart with her arm."
He held his arm over his chest. She looked away from his gesture. "Did anybody hear the gunshots?"
"If they did, they're not saying. We did the door-to-door, but on Marcy Street..."
He shook his head. "Yeah, I know."
"Why are you so interested in the case? Did you know her? Or you just got a thing about your beat?"
"Both. A .38 is not the gangster's choice these days," she said.
"You're right. We usually see more nines and .380s used by the gangs and dealers. You got any likely suspects?"
he asked. She didn't answer right away. "Not really."
Wills nodded to the body snatchers, who began to load the bodies onto gurneys. He helped Salt tear down the yellow tape and bundle it into a dented dumpster. "My dogs are Pansy and Violet," he offered.
"You're kidding me, right?" She laughed.
"No, what's so funny? Who wants to hug on something named Spike or Killer?"
"Well, homicide detectives are not normally known as huggers."
"I can hug."
He feigned hurt feelings.
"Okay, okay."
She laughed again, but couldn't quite let go of this chance for information on Chanel. "Don't forget, if you get anything more on Marcy Street, let me know." They stood side by side at the rotten meat-smelling dumpster, looking out at the crime scene. After a few awkward minutes, Wills broke off and headed toward his car.
"Be careful," he called to Salt.
"Okay." She lifted her hand and watched as Gardner came out of the building, looked at Wills, who was still watching her, and grabbed Wills's arm, laughing and pulling him toward the detective car. Gardner shoved Wills in the unmarked and drove off, Wills waving back toward her cruiser. Pepper came up, smiling.
"What's with Wills?"
"Just talking about dogs."
"I'm glad you're finally having conversations with somebody about something other than Chanel," he said, dropping into his cruiser.
"Yeah, looks like he and I have something in common," Salt said, lifting a strand of crime scene tape into the trash. Chapter 12. Sister Connolly and Booty Green. On Saturday afternoon, it was raining hard when Salt stopped the cruiser in front of Sister Connolly's. One small, blimp-sized cloud seemed to be dumping its heavy load here on Marcy Street only,
on the old woman's all-garden yard, like God personally watering sisters Forsythia, Azalea, Jasmine, Wisteria, Honeysuckle, and Cherokee Rose. New growth plants were scattered around in make-do planters, coffee cans and old buckets, inching green sprouts above their rims. The cloudburst had not had the breadth, duration, or strength to wash the grime off the projects. Salt lowered the car window to catch the fragrance of rain on green. Sister's yard shamed the worn dirt in front of the apartments on the other side of the street. A plyboard cover had been nailed across the entrance to Chanel's building. Someone had finally, in a way, fixed the door. Slanted graffiti blurred into the fake wood of the barrier. Words scrawled in various colors, hard to decipher. Capital letters and lowercase letters, random, some backward, like an ancient language, the handwriting of some ghetto god. Meanie, meanie, tekel, parson. Chanel's building, like Babylon, ready to fall into ruin. Walls cracked, windows broken, forsaken by anyone who cared. In contrast, Sister Connolly's small 100-year-old folk Victorian cottage seemed bursting with energy, with its one gable front and what was probably once a shotgun house, and a 20-foot wing added to the right of the original structure. Rivulets poured from the narrow porch. Hanging baskets crowded one another, vying for the rain and sunlight, and shading a two-seater swing. Precisely cut, neat patches of tin and old advertising signs had been added here and there to cover spots where the wood siding had fallen off. One rusted piece read Skull, with a faded picture of a snuff can. Salt sat for a while in the car, waiting for the rain to let up. The storm beating and beating with hard, fast drops for a few short minutes. Then it was gone. The hot sun appeared and began turning the puddles into steam. Sister Connolly was on the porch by the time Salt had started up the steps, the wood worn so that water puddled in the middle of each plank.
"I know you ready for some iced tea," the tall woman pronounced.
Like the house, she seemed steady and durable. "Yes, ma'am, if you got some made."
"Always keep tea in the frigidaire. Come on in."
Salt had to adjust her eyes when she passed into the house. All the shades and drapes were pulled shut, keeping the little house cool. The front parlor was crowded. Upholstered furniture, pillows, doilies, afghans, throw rugs over the woven carpet, a maze of objects and shadows. Framed photographs of individuals and groups, decades represented in aging hues, hung on walls and propped on tables and shelves. Sister was a woman who knew most everybody, their families, and their history.
"Sit, sit," said Sister.
The old woman went down a dark hall, disappearing into the dim, like Alice's rabbit. Salt's sense of her own over-average height and proportion began to grow in the close room. "Radio, hold me out on an information-only call," she spoke quietly into the mic on her shoulder. Sister returned with two jars.
"You hear about Chanel," she said,
offering the tea, then bending her body into a worn armchair. "Just asking around. Have you thought of anything more? Remember anything else? Did you hear the gunshots or see anybody over there around the time Chanel was killed?" She took a sip of the iced tea. It was sweet, 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 almost like cold syrup.
"You know now. I've known Chanel's family for a long time. Fact is, her mother, Mrs. McLeod, is a cousin of mine, second or third on my mother's side. They was always a righteous family."
While Sister Connolly always seemed open and forthright in their previous encounters and conversations, Salt often had the feeling that Sister's native language wasn't modern English, but something else, though she had no particular accent. It was as if she was translating in her head before she spoke. She was doing it now, looking upward and to the left before talking. A pause, a look up, her clear, bright brown eyes lifting above wire-frame glasses. Daniel interpreting for Belshazzar.
"Are you there, 3306?"
radio called.
It wasn't until Chanel fell in with Daryl Mobley, Lil D's dad, that she started on the downslide.
"Yes, 3306 here," answered Salt. Sister Connolly smoothed her loose flowered shift over her knees, then took a snuff tin off the side table. She offered the opened tin. Salt smiled, shaking her head no. The old woman put a pinch between her teeth and lower lip.
"Them Mobley kids always been bad, but I had hoped Big D would turn around. I had hoped he would not be loose like his mother."
3306, meet narcotics, radio said. Sister's voice was lower when she continued.
"He had no daddy to speak of. Chanel was good for him, but life kind of pulled them both down. You might say history caught up with them."
She leaned and spit into a pink ceramic vase on the table beside her, then took a sip from the tea jar. From somewhere in the shadows, a clock ticked in the muffled silence. Sister turned toward the sound of the ticking clock.
"Chanel got away from Big D, and for a while was doing all right, till she got pregnant with that little girl. She and Big D already had Lil D, so she gave the girl to her mama to raise, and Lil D went to Mrs. Mobley, too, when Chanel took to the street."
3306 copy. Meet narcotics, Salt responded, eager for the call she'd been listening for, ready to go, and taking a long drink of the tea to finish it in a hurry.
"They calling you?"
"Yes, sorry," she said, standing. "Thank you for the tea."
"You stop by again. Us old folks don't get many visitors, and most people around here I don't want on my porch, much less in my house. They act like dogs."
"No, ma'am. My dog is polite. The people act like nobody trained them right, or cared about what they did."
"You right, you right. But Chanel loved her girl. She wanted Mary to have something. Didn't want her ever in the street like Lil D. Hoped her mama would be a better mama."
Sister stopped mid-sentence, looked away as if at a sudden memory. Salt hurried to the porch, radio asking for her ETA to the corner. She bounded the steps to her car, waving to the old woman as she drove off. Halfway down the block, with the odor of green leaves, new flowers, and damp yard still following her, she realized Sister had never answered her questions about whether she saw or heard anything. She backed up, inhaling the exhaust from her own vehicle. Sister Connolly was still standing on the porch. From the car window, Salt asked again,
"Do you know anything that would help us find out who killed Chanel?"
Her mouth felt dry and sticky. The sweet tea had made her thirstier than before.
"You come back to see me again, Miss Salt."
Pepper was answering radio, starting for the corner, the sergeant calling her radio number, asking for her location. She pulled off again from Sister Connolly's, and with a screech of the siren, busted past the stop sign at the corner. The only people in the parking lot at Sam's were a couple of uniformed cops, some plainclothes detectives in takedown masks, and Booty Green, handcuffed, shackled, and lying face down on the pavement. A wiggle of elation and apprehension bounced around in Salt's chest. Booty would be the first gang member to fall in her campaign. She'd missed the takedown, but wanted to be there to deliver a message for Man-Man. She got out of the car and went over to Saul Chambers, her narcotics friend.
"Thanks for the help, Saul."
Hugging him, in part, for the benefit of the shadows across the street.
"No problem," We have to put in 8 anyway. It was easy, just like you said. He,
Sol pointed at Green,
sold to Junior, and we watched him get the hit from a stash and back. But better, he was carrying a stolen 380 pistol. He'll be in the federal system because of the gun and won't be getting out on bond.
Salt had known Chambers since her academy days, and they had kept up with occasional phone calls, usually work-related, and running into each other in the street and in court. When she had called asking for his help at the gang's corner, he was eager to make a dent there and to be able to report results from that location. He had been even happier that the surveillance, which took so much time, had already been done. She walked over to Green and the narcotics detective standing over him. "I'll take him to the wagon," she offered. He nodded and walked away to join some of the other cops. She knelt down. Green turned his face toward her, sweat pouring down his forehead, causing bits of dirt and small pieces of pavement to stick to the side of his cheek. He was overweight by about 50 pounds and breathing hard. "You can blame Man-Man for this, Booty. So when you call him from jail, tell him that." Green glared at her.
"You did."
She stared back. "Booty, the only way you can help yourself on a federal charge is to give me what you know about who killed Chanel."
"Man, I don't know anything about that."
"Yeah, maybe. Maybe not. But if anybody comes forward for you with the information, you can get your sentence reduced. That's the way the feds work."
"Fuck that."
"Think about it. Here's my card and phone number." She rolled him on his side, tucked the card in his shirt pocket, and hoisted him to his feet.
"Get your hands off me, bitch!"
He jerked his tethered arm from her grasp. "Who's the bitch, Booty? You're going to jail 'cause Man tells you to jump and you say how high. Call me if you want some years of freedom back." Salt left him to the wagon driver, then walked to the edge of the parking lot, knowing that they were watching from across the street. She lifted a hand, a challenge, to the watchers in the dark. Pepper came up.
"What are you doing? You gone crazy?"
"I was just helping Saul." A sharp pain in her head made her eyes start to water.
"Your hormones acting up? First you're late on an in-progress call, and now I catch you waving at UFOs."
Laughing with relief that he hadn't figured out what she was up to, she turned to him.
"No, just practicing my salute for when you make chief," she said,
resisting the urge to wipe her eyes.
"When pigs fly. So are we on for this weekend? Anne's already cooking."
"As long as you promise no unexpected guy will show up."
"Oh, good grief, Danny wasn't that bad."
"He wanted me to handcuff him, for God's sake."
"So, what's wrong with that?"
She flipped him the finger and went to thank Chambers and the other detectives again. As the wagon pulled off with Booty, the scene began to clear, and she went to get in her own car. Pepper came over again.
"You gonna tell me now what you're doing?"
He was standing close in the wedge of her open car door. Seemed like he wasn't in the dark after all. "Community policing, the new trend in the war on crime." She smiled, quoting a recent department directive, trying to make light of her action.
"I'm serious. What message are you trying to send? What did you say to Booty?"
She looked up, and feeling crowded by his tall body, said, "You're in my door." He lifted his hands and backed away.
"Don't get jammed up with them," he said,
sounding like he'd let it go for the moment. "Pepper."
"I mean it. You work too close sometimes."
"That's what works here. You know it. You have to get close. Close enough to
get hurt."
Pepper stopped her.
"Don't try to do this by yourself."
He turned to go to his car, then turned back.
"Why do you take stuff on all by yourself? You don't have to prove anything."
He got in his car and slammed the door, windows closed. She rolled the car windows down to better hear the night, drove out of the parking lot, following Pepper while Radio was giving out a call to another unit. There was a loud blast, and Pepper, a couple of car lengths in front of her, swerved and came to a stop. She hit her blue lights, braked beside his car, got out, and ran up to him, then realized that his car was leaning to the right.
"Damn, I thought it was a gunshot. I didn't think tires still blew out that way," he said, looking up at her from the window.
He puffed his cheeks, blew out a long breath, and got out. They both went to the passenger side of the car. The front tire was ripped open.
"Radio, start me a wrecker for a flat," Pepper advised dispatch.
Salt walked back to her car, trying to calm her breathing. On the hill above, something in motion reflected light from the street. She yelled back to Pepper,
"I need to go finish a report. Do you need me here?" "I've got blue lights. Go."
The car hung in first gear on the short drive around to the home's entrance. She drove until she got to near where she thought the flash had come from. A sharp right turn led to the buildings that faced the Chicken Place dope hole and overlooked the street where Pepper waited for the wrecker. She drove slowly, straining to see in the shadows. Parallel with where Pepper was stopped, she parked and got out. There was no one in sight. Her flashlight covered sequential sections of the area as she walked toward the hill lined with water oaks and low, leafless shrubs. The beam caught movement at the far edge of the tree line, an arm, light brown shirt, slipping back around toward the apartments. Picking up the pace, she followed her flashlight's beam, skipping over the ground. Around the corner of the end building, whoever had been on the hill had disappeared. Back to where the brown shirt had been when she first caught sight of him, she found herself standing directly above Pepper. The wrecker now parked in back of his cruiser, the driver and Pepper changing the tire. The ground around her was rutted and ugly. In the dirt, littered with cigarette butts and food wrappers, were shell casings, most dull with age. But glinting brightly, there was one that caught the glare of her light. She grabbed it up quickly and held it in her closed palm. It still held the faint heat of being recently struck, fired, and ejected. From the other side of the building, behind her, little girls' voices echoed. "Red Rover, Red Rover, let Cece come over." "Pepper," she said, exhaling quietly. Chapter 13. Hunting Big D Again. She took a personal leave day on Sunday. Other than the red digits of the clock on the dresser that glowed 5 a.m., the bedroom was dark. Only a little gray-blue light coming from the moonlit hall. Wonder groaned at the foot of the bed. The dreams of boards had recurred, boards swinging, dangling from that one hinge on Chanel's apartment door, merging with the dream of her own hands on rough boards, trying to fit them to a chair in a foggy forest clearing. An electric needle-like pain sizzled along the scar in her hair. Since the expressway, when she tried to get to sleep at night, psychedelic beads would cross under her closed lids, like involuntary sheep counting, and during the day, fuzzy white movements blurred her peripheral vision. Salt kept thinking it would clear up. Sarge would stick her behind a desk for sure if there was any question about her fitness for duty. She'd be of no help to Chanel in the office. Standing at the kitchen sink, she drank a strong cup of Cuban coffee, while looking out to the still dark backyard, the silent sheep, and black-trunked trees. She fluffed the dog's fur and admonished him to stay before closing the door. The sky to the east began to grow a peachy haze as she drove toward the city. It felt strange to see, odd to make the trip this time of day on her own time, wearing her own clothes rather than the uniform. coffee buzz zinging in her veins. She hoped it would keep her clear-eyed for a while. At 6 a.m., she made a turn off Peachtree onto Pine Street. People who mistakenly turned off Atlanta's much-celebrated Main Street onto Pine quickly realized their error. Dozens of men were hanging out in front of a building that spread over a city block. In the parking lot across the street, dejected men sat along all the rest of the sidewalk, their legs in the gutter, possessing the curbside. She parked next to a hydrant, the only close space, looked at the faces of the two guys closest to her Honda, then closed and locked her car doors. For men only, Haven House was the largest facility for the homeless in the city. It was downtown and out of her precinct. Her beat had several other shelters, and Salt had been able to check all of them during duty hours. But she hadn't found Big D. Like most of the shelters, Haven House emptied out in the early dawn hours. She'd gotten there 45 minutes past her cup of coffee. Weather-worn, ragged men sat against the wall, sandwiched by garbage bags of belongings. Wild-eyed men guarded grocery carts filled with cans and pieces of metal. Flattened men in the parking lot across the street slept on cardboard beds next to the scraggly bushes. She crossed the narrow street. Just before the curb in front of the entrance, a man in a dark shirt and dark suit stepped in front of her.
"I'm Reverend Black. Do you know where you're going?"
Salt tried to step around him. He moved back in front of her. She said, "You're in my way."
"You searching high and low, here and there."
Reverend Black waved his arms. She moved to go around him again, and again he jumped in front of her.
"Sister, we all searching, but you won't find what you need here."
Salt pulled out her badge, and as the light struck the silver, Reverend Black stiff-armed a Bible in front of his face.
"And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them, and the glory of the Lord shone round about them, and they were sore afraid."
She passed by him, badge to Bible. Just inside the entrance, a guy sitting at a dented metal desk traced his finger down the rows of a ledger book. He had on a dingy T-shirt, and there was a cigarette hanging from a corner of his mouth. Ashes had spilled on the front of the shirt, on the shelf of his stomach. He didn't look at her or the badge that she had kept open in her palm. Someone yelled from the back of the hall,
"Rev Gray, he's stinking the place up!"
The desk man yelled back,
"Either get him the fuck out or I'm calling the cops."
He looked up and saw Salt. Before he noticed the badge in her hand, he said,
"Lady, the entrance for the soup kitchen volunteers is around the corner. You got the wrong door."
Then he noticed the badge.
"Well, a cop when you need one. I'm Reverend Gray."
Stretching across the desk, he shook her hand and stood up.
"Come on. Let's get this guy out of here."
He got up and rushed her down the dim corridor. Salt stopped midway down the hall.
"No, you don't understand. I'm not on duty. I'm here because I'm looking for a guy."
Reverend Gray said,
"Lady, I need a cop now. This guy is tearing the place up and shitting on the floor. I need you to get him out of here one way or another."
"Is there more than one exit?" Salt thought of Big D's propensity for wandering away. They came to the entrance of a cavernous room that looked to have once been used as a warehouse. In spite of the roaring wall fans, it smelled of dirty feet, urine, and rotted flesh. Sleeping pads lined the space, four rows on each side of the room, as far as she could see into the deep corners, a corridor half a block long down the middle. With the early morning turnout, most of the spaces were empty at this hour.
"The only other exits are alarmed. Ring like a freaking banshee," said Gray.
Squatting 10 mats away was a troll-looking, blonde-bearded guy. He had his pants down and was letting diarrhea onto one of the sleeping mats.
"God damn it! That's the 5th pad this week," Gray said.
"Call 911 for an ambulance,"
He's got DTs.
We already called. They take their time coming here.
Paramedics hated these shelter calls. The patients were often drunk and belligerent, and left terrible odors in the ambulances for the rest of the shift. She pulled out her phone and identified herself to the 911 call taker. ETA 5 minutes. She pocketed the phone. The sick man groaned and swatted at his demons. Sunday morning light was filling the space. An old hymn bored its way into Salt's consciousness. Will there be any stars in my crown, when at evening the sun goeth down? Outside, Reverend Black shouted,
We all searching!
Salt turned to Reverend Gray and pulled out a mugshot of Big D. I don't want to arrest him, she said, handing him the photo. I'm looking for information on the murder of his son's mother. The smoke from Gray's cigarette rose back toward his face, and he squinted with one eye, studying the photo. He looked out into the long room.
He's there, at the back, by the window.
Salt's worrisome eyesight was strained by the growing light from the back of the huge room. She could just barely make out a figure, illuminated in a shaft of sunshine. Whether it was the coffee wearing off or her impaired vision, she began to feel sluggish. Reverend Gray coughed.
Bleh!
He hung his head and leaned on the doorframe.
Damn!
He struck his chest, clearing the phlegm.
There are a few residents that are allowed to stay during the day. He's one of them.
Why?
Special circumstances.
Gray left her, coughing his way down the hall. She walked toward the back, her head pulsing with each step. Fuzzy images merged and converged the closer she got. Chanel, trapped in the back seat while they searched for Big D after he'd been stabbed, trying to find a pulse on his heavy, bleeding body. By the time she reached the back of the room, the peripheral had become tangled with what was in front of her. It was him. Barely. It had been almost 2 months, but she had found him. She had. And Big D wasn't big anymore. He would have been hard for anyone to recognize. His clothes hung on his bones. He was gray and ashy-looking, his eyes bloodshot and watery. He sat on a metal folding chair, staring out the meshed glass window, and didn't seem surprised to see her.
You ever have a dream where somebody appears where they usually don't belong?
He turned his head back to the window.
How did you find me?
One arm was pressed against his chest. Flat resignation in his voice. They pay us to find people, you know, she said, trying on a small smile. Salt looked out the window so that she and Big D were sharing the same view. A large Gothic stone church loomed near, the city hospital in the distance. When she turned her head to look back at D, her vision blurred again. She forgot for a moment what it was she was there to ask, and stammered the first thing that came to mind. What about Lil D?
I'd done the best I could. I didn't know no other way.
D, did you kill her?
You asking if I shot her? The answer is no. Life killed her, and it's gonna kill me too. Ain't none of us getting out of this shit alive.
Lil D thinks you killed her.
He's a kid. Kids see so much they don't know how to reason out.
Salt shut her eyes for a second. Do you know who might have wanted her dead?
Chanel whoring for crack. Whoring to pay man. Last time she cut me, you arrested her, and I stopped being with her. I'd see her, though, on the corner hanging with that skinny red hoe.
He pressed his long arm against his chest, then reached across to hold his left side.
You wouldn't think I'd grieve for her.
I would, she said. but I have to ask. Do you or did you own a gun?
I don't own nothing. No gun. I don't care about no gun. Never have.
Is the woman Chanel was hanging with called Dirty Red?
Yeah.
The fuzzy light flashed. You staying here because of Lil D?
Yeah, Lil D. If I go back to the homes, we both get hurt, or dead. So until you lock somebody up for killing his mama, it's best I stay here.
His arm looked tired, hanging down beside him. That's still bothering you? She nodded to the side where Chanel had cut him.
No, it's my heart. They can't do nothing for me, he said. Doctor called it a rested heart, something like that. That's another reason I'm here, looking to die.
He turned back to the window.
I'd like it to die next to that church out there, and not in jail.
For a second, Big D came into clearer focus. Inept car thief, dying man, father, Chanel's love. He stared out to the filigreed church spire. Pigeons were taking off from stone petals and catching drafts between buildings. She put a card with her phone number on the sill and quietly walked back between the rows to the front of the shelter. The troll man hovered in a corner. The two reverends were standing on each side of the exit, Reverend Black with his Bible, Reverend Gray lighting another cigarette. Both turned as she got to the door.
Was it him? You still searching?
They asked simultaneously. Salt said, still searching. Not directing it at either one, she walked out to the sound of a siren soaking the Sunday morning air. The church bells competed, sounding more like a clang this close to the skyscrapers. In her car, she squinched down to look up one more time at the steeple. Big D had a better view from the window above. Chapter 14. A Girl, a Dog, and Escape. The flowers, catkins of the pecan trees, dangled like tiny ornaments from the deepening green branches of the orchard. Salt stood underneath, watching the sunlight and breeze turn the trees into a jade and yellow-white kaleidoscope canopy. She'd just gotten home from locating Big D and paused for a minute after getting out of the car, sorting through the possibilities and thinking about how to find Dirty Red, when Mr. Gooden came from around the side of the house with Wonder, a loose lead rope around the dog's neck. The old man and his now-deceased wife had been her parents' long-time neighbors. At 80 years old, he was still tall and always seemed sunburned, a small belly pressed out over the top of his wide, tight belt.
"This rotten beast was staring at my cows again," he said with a grin, nodding toward his pasture to the west and the brown impressions of the loosely scattered herd on the green, far field.
I'm sorry. Did he hurt anything?
No. Like usual, he just watches.
He ruffled Wonder's fur and slipped the rope off. She bent down and took her dog's snout between her palms. I'm not sure why he gets the notion, but sometimes I catch him looking longingly toward your herd. He's too smart for his own good. Straightening, she remembered. Thank you again for the onions and the flowers.
Let me have a look at you.
He took hold of her shoulders and held her at arm's length while he studied the crease in her hair. His survey parodied one he might make of prized stock.
From the outside, that wound looks to be healing.
He turned his head, eyeing her first with one eye, then the other. Salt stood under his scrutiny, feeling childlike, awkward but good in his large red hands.
I'm just sorry there wasn't more I could do.
He dropped his hold on her.
How's your mother?
He asked.
I'm surprised she didn't come down when you were injured. It must add to her worries something terrible.
I talked to Mom a couple of days ago, I guess. She bent to pick burrs from Wonder's coat, trying to untangle them rather than pull his fur. She's as good as can be. I didn't see any need to tell her I got shot. She didn't look up at the old man, who was silent while she picked at the burrs. She mumbled to Wonder, "You get all these watching cows?"
As she stood, she gave the dog a firm spank on his haunch that sent him into a tail-wagging frenzy. Wonder shook himself and trotted to the fence and the sheep. Mr. Gooden had his lips between his teeth like he was holding back words, silently watching the dog.
"Lord, nobody but you and the dog. Alone again."
He cleared his throat.
"I read in the paper that you were by yourself when you pulled the car over. Don't you have partners?"
He didn't stop for her to answer.
"I'm going to say this now, even though you might see it as minding your business, and I might say it wrong, but you just almost got killed, part because you were alone. I'm not trying to play amateur shrink, but I wonder if you've gotten too used to, well, taking on too much by yourself. I remembered how much your mother loved flowers, and that made me remember Peggy picking some just like those from the field back there."
He pointed to some splashes of red and yellow at the back of his property.
"She asked me to bring some to your mother. You would have been about 10.
Hearing 10, she immediately put up her hand, palm out. "That was a bad year for my parents. Dad was sick a lot, and then there was the accident. They didn't want people to know, especially my mother. Wanted to keep their privacy." Mr. Gooden pointed his finger at her chest.
"Privacy is one thing, Sarah. But at the expense of a child? That's not right."
She interrupted him. "I grew fast that year. They counted on me, and I didn't want to let them down. Hindsight is 20/20. Mr. Gooden kept on.
"I knew your folks well enough by then, I thought, to just drop in. But that day when I got here, and I knocked on the back door and didn't get an answer, I came on into the porch. I stood at the screen door to the kitchen. Your dad was sitting beside the table, and you had a pan and were on the floor washing his feet. Before I even said hello, your mother came to the door and stood like she was blocking out you and your dad, like you weren't there. I've thought about that day over and over. It wasn't that you were taking care of your dad. It was the way your mother held herself. Even though she's a small bit of a woman, she seemed that day like a rock wall, with her hands on her hips, elbows out, and her feet wide apart."
He shook his head.
"I handed her the flowers. I can't remember anything we said, just the way she stood."
He shifted, looking again way back to the end of his property, to where the blur of flowers grew.
"You had too much of a burden for a child. Peggy and I talked about it. We both worried about how alone you seemed after your dad died. Before he died, I used to see the two of you everywhere together."
Salt scattered the pile of burrs with the toe of her boot. "I'm not sure I understand," she told him. "My dad was worn out from work that year. He loved soaking his feet and getting a foot rub. That's all."
"Your mother didn't want anybody to know how bad things were with your father."
"Mr. Gooden, I don't see how dragging all this up..." He held up his hand, palm toward her, to let him finish.
"Sometimes, whenever your father got really bad, she'd call Peggy to come over to stay with you and your brother. The night of your father's accident, She ran to our house. She left you with him again, even with you finding him and all.
He shook his head.
And in the years since she moved away and Peggy died, I've wanted to say something.
Day, she corrected him, turned and started walking for the house. He walked beside her.
What?
It was daytime when my father shot himself. Salt was at the back door and turned to face the old man. She did the best she could.
No, Sarah.
He looked at her straight on.
She should have asked for help, not left a child, you, with him. That was no time to let pride get in the way. She left you with something a child couldn't handle. What's that saying? Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. And now here you are. I don't know.
Salt reached up and touched her scalp. It was my birthday. She went to get a cake and balloons for me. I haven't really forgotten anything. They both looked down, then out toward where the dog was looking. The cows were far away. Finally, he laughed.
Nobody but you would have rescued this crazy dog or put up with him, even buying him sheep to herd.
He coiled the short rope and slapped it against his leg.
I'd best be getting to the cows. I hope I didn't overstep.
He kept whipping the rope against his jeans as he headed for the field between the two houses. Mr. Gooden, she said as goodbye.
Keep safe, Sarah.
He climbed the fence, crossed to the other side with the agility of an 8-year-old, only with locked knees. She had thought about telling him that her mother said he would look out for her. There was a brief ruffle of a breeze. Wonder lifted his snoot. Salt took a breath, inhaling a trace of old roses. The Sunday noon sun made the wind blow hot and dry, but Wonder didn't notice. He was standing perfectly still, 10 yards away from her, his dark eyes focused on the sheep, his black fur blowing almost horizontal with his body. She loved the place. The old trees, the connection with her father's family, the orchard. This was her father's. She sent the dog around to the far right of the sheep, and as he ran, she felt her own muscles as if she were running with him, a black-haired girl again, pretending to catch a bad guy and protecting the innocent. There, she called. He stopped, facing the sheep. Salt asked him to do only what he wanted, what he could do, gather the sheep. The little flock moved toward her as the pressure of the dog at their backs increased. She turned to lead them toward the paddock near the house. The big white house loomed sweet and aging. She loved the way it looked from here, all worn, but well put together, white on white, trim and dormers, porches over porches. The downstairs drew in breezes, and the central long hall kept a stream of cool air circulating. Her gaze was drawn upward to the second floor. It felt good for Mr. Gooden to have told her, keep safe. She remembered her father's voice.
Your eyes are dark blue, like a newborn baby's. Where did you get those eyes?
From you, Papa. Then he would sleep in the afternoon. Her mother would tell her, watch your father. She had done what her mother had asked most of the time. It made her feel powerful, but unhappy. Now she turned back toward the sheep. Her breath evened out. Her skin collected the sun while the wind tousled her hair over the healing scar. The black-haired girl had run, climbed, and jumped. And in exhaustion, found peace. Now, when she was on duty, after a street fight got settled, a successful arrest made, she felt release.
A car or foot chase sometimes let loose a memory of some story her father had told. Mr. Gooden may be right, she thought. I haven't handled it. Chapter 15 Of the Female Persuasion. As soon as she came down the drive to the precinct, arriving for her evening shift, Salt saw Sister Connolly with Major Townsend, their area commander. They were standing on the south side of the precinct, the major looking up at Sister, who not only had the advantage of being taller, but was also above him on the incline. They were accompanied by several of the supervisory staff, two lieutenants and three sergeants, all sweating, mopping their brows, and looking at the base of the bushes beside the precinct wall. Salt headed up the banked yard as soon as she got out of her car, just in time to see Sister push the major into a stoop while she pointed at the base of one of the hydrangeas. Salt had never seen anyone touch the major. He wasn't that kind of person. She hurried up the hill to the group, just as Major Townsend asked, "Where do I get the manure?" He sounded uncharacteristically frustrated, and maybe a little shrill. "I can bring some sheep manure from home," Salt said, arriving just as Sister handed the major a handful of dirt. The brass all turned at once to look at Salt. "Sheep manure, it's just as good, maybe better than any other, than cow or horse," Salt explained.
"Sheep manure," repeated the major.
"Yes, sir." Sister acknowledged Salt.
"There you go. Right under your nose, one of your officers has what you need to start getting this yard to where it should be, setting an example. After all, this is city property. You could also grow vegetables with all this yard. Give some to the homeless shelters. At least take care of these shrubs and bushes. Make them shine."
She showed no sign of letting the major off the hook.
"Shine," repeated the major. He seemed incapable of getting ahead in the conversation. "And plant some perennials and annuals both, raised beds. All these young folks, strong men, and you got a sick yard like this. Is this the way you take care of your zone? Your employees? No wonder those uniforms look so shabby. Crime off the chart."
Sister was wearing a simple blue cotton dress without a wrinkle, and she was carrying a pocketbook on one arm, like the queen. White gloves were folded over the handle. The major was in trouble. "Sister," Salt interrupted, "are you here to see me?" The major stumbled down the hill towards Salt.
"Yes, Sister Connolly, Officer Salt can help you with whatever you need."
He held up his hand as Sister started to speak.
"With what we need for the precinct yard."
He was on his way up the back steps before he finished the sentence. He turned to his administrative lieutenant.
"Make sure we get this situation resolved, Lieutenant."
While the sergeants and lieutenants dispersed, Salt walked with Sister around the back and to the other side of the residential-style precinct house. "Sister, you didn't come by just to give us a gardening lesson." Salt grinned. "Not that we couldn't use it." She picked some yellowed leaves off another plant.
"This yard is a mess. But I came by because I remembered how I recognize you."
"I'm sure you've seen me on the beat. I've been your evening watch officer for about 10 years now, and of those 10 years, I've probably spent total time, months or so, just answering calls on Marcy Street. You and I have talked several times."
"Of course, but it wasn't until you came asking about Chanel that I really got close enough to you to know that it was your daddy I was remembering."
"My daddy." Salt heard herself say the words before they sank in. Sister Connolly talking about her dad?
"I remember him for a couple of reasons." "You all right? I'm sorry if I upset you. but I thought that since your daddy died so long ago, what, 20 years, that you'd be okay if I brought it up. Is your head healing proper? I heard about the expressway.
I'm fine. It's just that not many people remember my dad, and even if they do, they don't talk about him to me. I was just caught off guard. I'd like to know more about him, especially about his work.
You'll like him, you know. Even though I met him after he became a police officer, I also knew of him before because some of my family come from around Cloud, where his family had that big farm.
Salt smiled. It's not so big now, just the house and a few acres. I'm the only one left living there. That's where I have the sheep.
I see.
Sister took a couple of steps away, and then turned sideways to Salt, looking off in the direction of Cloud.
Too many folks in this town forget that we, lots of us who grew up in Atlanta, come from or have family that came from the country. And in this town, the country is not far, half an hour, or a year or so, or half a century, or a century past the railroad tracks. And in some directions, the country is right up against this big city, little places like Cloud. Not that I'd want to go back. No, sir.
Sister slapped her hand and arm against her thigh, the sound like wet cloth hitting a river rock, and stood there, looking away. Salt said, I've got about 30 pecan trees in the orchard. I feed the sheep, but they also graze.
Oh, I know about those big old pecan trees around Cloud. My sister had one of the big ones where she lived, right next to her in our auntie's house.
Sister Connolly went back to looking off. A screechy cicada signaled in early evening, beginning his ratchety crescendos and diminuendos. Sister turned her head back to Salt as they walked to her preacher's big sedan, parked at the curb. He didn't look up as they approached, just kept reading the Bible, propped on the steering wheel, its soft leather binding bending to fit between the spokes. You said you knew my dad through his work, right?
That's how we figured out about our Cloud connection. But yes, yes, I met him because of his policing. You'll like him about that. He talked to people, get to know them. Atlanta is not so big a city. Some want to call it a city. It's just a railroad town.
I'd like to know what he talked about. Was he asking you about cases he was working? How often did you see him?
Our roads didn't cross all that often. It was usually over some crime problem he was working on nearby. Mossy Street used to be real nice, especially before they built those apartments. He'd drop in whether or not he thought I'd know anything or about anybody involved. That's why I realized who you were. Didn't recognize your name since everybody calls you Officer Salt. I know you better now that I know who your daddy was.
She made a sound, humphed, something between a laugh, a cough, and a grumble, and settling into the seat, she said,
You come by. We'll talk.
She pulled the door closed and nodded to Reverend Stevenson, who put down the good book and put the car in gear. Jesus loves the little children, all the children of the world, red and yellow, black and white. Red. She needed to find Red. All night, the old Sunday school song had kept running through her mind. It was a hot night, and Salt was now surrounded by whores. Calvin's Motel was one of her regular stops. It was called Calvin's, even though Calvin hadn't been in evidence since Pepper found him 7 years ago and served him on a warrant for pimping a 9-year-old. It was a 1-story building of 20 single-door rooms, L-shaped, and set up on a hill overlooking the avenue, a south side street notorious for its sex trade,
A driveway made a U from the street up the hill around the front. Johns would drive through and take their pick from the girls, hoping the dress of the whore indicated their willingness to cater to a particular fetish. Leather and